captain, the Kiev, there's a life sign. Someone is alive inside that ship.
We need to set course for the Veruba Nebula.
Keep an eye on your radiation levels.
We'll still need to be back in 4 hours.
Whatever answers we find, I just hope they're enough.
A ship approaching.
She's got weapons locked, ready to jump.
No, we can't leave them.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge in 2021.
This is Tyler Orton eating what he thought were genuine apples.
I made them specifically for you, Tyler.
Oh, that's so kind of you, Cam. They do have your essence to them, I must say.
Well, we're
what
here
was
this
the
week.
Point of that scene, Cam? That just like I'm like, okay. So, constantly when I'm watching like Discovery, I always ask myself like, what does this add or what is the point of this? And so often I don't know what the answer is. It's just Vance telling Osira that she's eating a pile of crap. I was just like, okay, is that like a power move? Is it supposed to reveal that this is a man that's never set foot on a planet? I don't know. I think they just thought it would sound badass or something. Who knows?
I think it was also trying to answer a question that no one really cared that much about in terms of how maybe replicators work.
Yeah.
Maybe? I guess? I don't know.
Do replicators work differently in the Emerald Chain?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Exactly.
And then I'm also wondering, exactly. Does that mean they're making, desks out of feces?
That's a lot of feces. Cam, you know what? I'm working from home now amid the pandemic. I think I'm going to save myself a couple dollars and build myself a new desk.
Yeah, well, you won't be inviting company over anytime soon, so that it might actually work for you for a short term.
Yeah. So Cam, that is from the episode 12 of season 3 of Discovery, There Is a Tide. We'll get into more depth in a few moments, but we're going to do a bit of a double header here. First up is episode 11, our review of Sukal, which the titular character is in fact the Kelpian, who is the cause of the burn because he threw a tantrum 120 years ago. Is that what you gathered from the episode?
Tyler, I actually wrote on a piece of paper my prediction of what caused the burn about two episodes into the season. So I'm going to read it to you right now.
Okay.
I believe it's a Kelpian man-child battling his imaginary sea kelp monster friend.
What? You got it right. Holy moly.
Right? Too obvious. Too obvious. Call
that old trope.
Okay. Yeah, I hated this episode. This might have been my least favorite episode of Discovery, bar none, across the board. But it had some things I like about it, so I will touch on those. But in terms of this decision of what caused the burn, I mean, I made notes while I was watching it, like Charlie X, I wrote that and underlined it. Like, it reminded me a lot of the classic Star Trek idea of kind of like the child god. You know, we saw that with Trelane on the original series as well. Q has elements of that. And I've seen people say, well, that's what they were doing. It's great. And I'm like, no. This reminds me of what I often hear studios do, franchise makers say is, you know, for example, Marvel will say, Ant-Man's our heist movie. That doesn't make it a good heist movie. That just makes it a thing.
Yeah.
To me, this was, we're doing a child god story. Okay. It was a terrible one. Doesn't matter that you did it.
Yeah, well, I'll say I did enjoy Doug Jones's performance outside of all the makeup, although I found his hairpiece incredibly distracting, and those glued-on sideburns those were also rather bothersome. But I did like to see him kind of really, you know, stretch his wings in terms of getting away from that makeup, really being able to emote in a way that Gal Gadot could only hope for.
Well, sure. I would like to see Doug Jones headlining his own DC franchise.
As Wonder Woman?
You know, Wonder Woman would be amazing. I feel like if you're going to cast Doug Jones as a DC character, probably Martian Manhunter, right? Like, that seems about in line for what you would cast Doug Jones for.
I'll take your word for it. My knowledge of DC is pretty much limited to what I saw in Justice League.
Sure, sure. He's a basically bald green alien. So it kind of fits the bill, I feel.
Okay.
But yeah, like, I'm with you. Like, I did like seeing the actor actually get to express emotions in a way we don't normally see. I thought that was a fun idea when the three of them all had different alien species when they beam into this ship here. But I tell you, man, when I watched Doug Jones walk in singing that lullaby at the climactic moment during the holographic monster versus, you know, man-child fight, I was like, I almost put my remote right through the TV.
Why? It took you right back to the death of one Commander Arium?
I mean, that's a good reference.
For those listeners that might not recall, we were just moved by one Doug Jones, a.k.a. Saru's singing during Arium's funeral following Project Daedalus. So. I'm sorry, Cam. Yeah. Continue on, sir.
Just that I watched this episode, you know, yesterday, and I'm glad that I gave myself some space, because had we recorded the episode directly after me watching that episode, I would not have been my best self.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what. I was a little higher on this episode when I watched it last week, and then I watched it once again right before we started recording, and I realized that the rewatch was a little bit more painful because I knew it was going to happen, and I didn't really care. Like, I knowing what the answers were, it made me much less invested in what was going to happen next. And I don't think that bodes very well for the rewatchability of Discovery moving forward. And I just look, they like to hang their season-long arcs on these mysteries that we've never found to be all that compelling. I find the Burn mystery to be particularly uncompelling. And now that we kind of know the answer, it's that man-child has some sort of genetic change that links him to the radiation of this dilithium planet, and his emotional well-being can trigger the collapse of the Federation. I was like, okay, that's not interesting at all.
Well, I think it could have worked. I thought the execution was very poor. Very, very poor. But I think it could have worked in a different way, where you didn't build the entire season around characters constantly asking what the burn is, because there is literally no way to guess what the solution is, or to even see it coming. It's entirely out of left field. It's like if I'd said, well, it was a hang gliding octopus, and you'd be like, well, that's weird. I wouldn't have seen that coming. But it's the same thing. It's like, there's no way for you to ever basically take 1 + 1 = this. So all those episodes we had of Burnham saying, I need to find the source of the burn. We go, okay, well, this must be tied to something. Something that we could maybe not necessarily guess, because I don't think it's a great thing if the audience can figure it out before the characters, but something that when we find out the reveal, we go, oh, of course, like, this does make sense how it, you know, you can kind of trace elements back to the, you know, the start of the season. This was just like, oh, okay, I guess, sure thing, whatever.
Yeah, the whole out of left field element, it makes you as an audience member question why you're even invested in what unfolds throughout the series, if, you know, it doesn't really matter, if they can just pull the rug out from underneath you and make the answer whatever they feel like it is in that moment. Now, I'm sure that they had planned this all out, you know, before they started writing episode one. I'm sure there's a whiteboard out there somewhere where this is what the key was going to be. And my suspicion is, because ultimately I think what we're getting set up for is Saru's departure as captain of the Discovery. And I really hope they don't think that we're going to be satisfied that after watching this character grow for 3 seasons to try to become captain, finally get that opportunity, have some showcase moments in which it was like, yeah, we understand why this guy is a leader now and why he was not, you know, a couple seasons ago. For them to just kind of make us so invested, and then I think we're going to have a situation where Saru has to stay on this planet and babysit the man-child, you know, moving forward, which is just, isn't that depressing to think about?
Well, not only is it depressing, it's also incredibly derivative, because we just dealt with this same season, if that's the outcome, where we had Nan have to hang out with the Borazan scientist who's kind of gone a little wacky. And that's basically the exact same thing we have here, where it would be Saru going to another member of his species who's obviously not in a very good state and having to stay to look after them. Like, that's doing that twice in a season? That's crazy.
And it involves radiation, too.
Yeah, like, the whole time I was watching this, I was like, this is so similar to that episode with the Borazan scientist. I'm like, what are they doing? Like, this is the exact same thing, but worse. I didn't think that was done particularly well in Die Trying, but at least I said, okay, it's okay. I can get past it because it's not focusing so much screen time on it. It was a little more of a B story in terms of the scientist. Like, he didn't take a massive amount of screen time up versus this, which was the majority of the screen time.
Yeah, I think in concept, they could have done something interesting here if this was, say, episode 5. You know, but the thing is they want us to believe we're in the home stretch of the season. And so much hangs just story-wise on this episode. And it didn't really work for me. But look, if we knew by episode 5 what the cause of the burn was, well, okay, then we can move on. But guess what? I don't think we're going to be able to move on. We're going to have to wait until season 4, which hopefully will come out, you know, by fall of this year. I guess I can say that now. So but there's other elements. Like, I think it's kind of fun if they try to do a holodeck program goes awry sort of episode. Execution is maybe another thing. But look, if you want to put Bajoran makeup on Culber, that's cool. I think SMG is getting off really easy if the only makeup she has to put on are the Trill spots. It would have been hilarious if they turned her into a Klingon for this episode with like 6 hours of makeup. But alas.
I just made a note. I said, fortunate that none of them were turned into a tribble.
That would have been pretty funny to watch.
I was like, hope when it showed Saru walking in, it's just like the like weirdly sexy shot of his feet walking in as the camera starts lifting up.
It's like Quentin Tarantino filmed that.
It felt like they were almost going for like after a post makeover scene or something where like they're panning up, like, take a breathtaking look, ladies and gentlemen. But I was like in my head as the camera's panning up, I'm trying to come up with what crazy alien he could possibly be. And then I was like, oh, actually, that's more fun actually to do Doug Jones without the makeup.
Yeah. And look, I think it was nice of the writers to give that actor a break for a week. So good on them. Cam, this gray payoff, it better be amazing, right?
Oh, it better be.
I don't know what to make of the storyline. It just, Gray keeps popping in and says, hey, Adira, I'm still here. I'm supposed to be connected, but I took off for a while. Adira's like, that wasn't cool. Well, I'm here now, Adira. I'm just like, oh my, like, where is this going? Where on earth is this going? Why have they stretched this out for like 7 episodes? I wish if they were going to introduce, you know, the first non-binary trans couple to Star Trek, that they would do it justice. And this is just such a listless sort of relationship that aside from one episode, Forget Me Not, which I thought was a great episode, probably my first or second favorite episode of season 3. And then just to see it unfold as it has, I'm just like, this is, you're killing me, guys. Like, please tell me by the finale, because we did not see a return of Gray in There Is a Tide. Maybe by the finale, it's going to be some amazing payoff or something. I don't know.
I mean, this is really bad writing of television. I think Forget Me Not was actually a great episode. I'm with you. I think that their chemistry, the relationship in that episode, really built it up to be something I was going to be greatly invested in going forward. And I mean, I definitely was rolling my eyes when Gray was just like, I just need some time. I just, you know, just not feeling it. Just need some time. And I was like making notes. I'm just like, what is going on? There was, I think, 3 moments in this episode where I literally just stared in disbelief like almost like slack-jawed at what was happening on screen. I mean, Saru walking in singing the lullaby at the climactic moment was one. This was a second, and I can't remember what the third is. Maybe it'll pop into my mind at some point. But with Gray just giving the most, like, as you said, like, listless, just kind of like, yeah, just wasn't around. I was like, are you serious? Like, this is your dramatic payoff to this relationship, to multiple episodes of Adira talking about the lack of, you know, communication with Gray and how much it's, you know, injuring their feelings? Like, it really, it felt weird. It felt so weird.
The reason why the writers, though, aren't assuming everyone's going to think it's dumb, you know, or that this is just bad writing, is because the writers know where they're going to by the end of the season. And I'm sure they're proud of whatever their answer is. The problem is we at home, we're watching it week to week, or else if you're binge watching it, you're not consuming it all at once. Like, they're like, it's just such a big ask of them for the audience to stick around with something that just seems so silly and frustrating to watch, you know? And I'm just like, I'm just so disappointed by how they've treated this relationship since that great episode when it was introduced at what, like episode 4, I think, of the season.
Yeah. And I think Adira has clicked as a character.
Yeah.
Gray is not a character at this point. So that's getting very frustrating.
What is Gray's most distinctive personality trait?
Just kind of a nice smile, aloof. I guess. Yeah, aloof.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Like, I don't know. Like, I can't tell you. Like, I agree. Like, I don't think Gray's a, like, a character. Like, it's very hard to define who this character's personality is. Whereas Adira, genius character. You know, kind of the wunderkind sort of character, the one that has like a very interesting relationship with Stamets, and to a lesser degree with Culber. Also somebody who has a lot of pathos going on as they wonder about the future with their partner who is in and out of the picture. You know, like, Adira is a fully fleshed out character. I just don't know what to make it of Gray at this point.
And Adira, you also have that intellectually far beyond their years, but emotionally not. And so you have that conflict, yeah, between a teenager's, you know, view of the world and understanding of their emotions mixed with an intellect far beyond most people. Like, that's interesting to watch, and it's a very good hook for a character. And, you know, I think Discovery's usually nailed down its characters fairly well. I haven't felt, you know, baffled the way maybe when we look at the first couple seasons of some of the other Star Trek shows where characters felt very fuzzy for a while. I feel like Discovery is pretty good at that, but Gray is the one that seems like they've really kind of dropped the ball.
Yeah. So the other stuff going on the ship with Osira taking it over and Tilly, you know, getting to sit in the captain's seat, her first big, you know, assignment, and then, well, the ship's taken over. I feel very mixed about this in that I find it just as realistic that Saru could have surrendered the vessel, you know? But unfortunately, mm-hmm, it's a situation where Tilly's character doesn't come off great, where she's given her first go and the ship's taken over. And look, we've seen that happen. Sisko lost the ship. Janeway lost the ship. It happens. I get it. But the back and forth between Tilly and Osira, I like those moments, you know, like they, Tilly was kind of giving her all with her own kind of bit of sass and all that. But was this really the same Tilly that we know? It seemed more like Mary Wiseman versus the Tilly that's so familiar to us, because she's mostly defined by her insecurities, despite having an incredibly supportive crew around her.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I too enjoyed the back and forth. I thought it was fun. This was actually my favorite aspect of this episode was the Tilly story. I thought that was the only one of, I guess, the three kind of stories going on that actually interested me and kept me involved. But no, I do agree. I think what we have here is a little bit of that case of the writers have gotten familiar with the actor and they're starting to write to the actor, which happens. It's not exclusive to Discovery. It happens in many a TV show. But I do feel like that was coming across here. They've figured out that, you know, Mary Wiseman can just nail these sorts of fun, you know, exchange moments. And so why not give her more of them? And I honestly thought the scene opposite, you know, Osira was probably the best moment of the episode. It's just that you're right. Like, Tilly is a character who the insecurity was always there and so strong. And to see her overcome them is what's compelling, not just, yep, they're done now, moving past it. That's just not as much fun.
Kind of like how Detmer has now completely overcome her PTSD.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, they still seem to have a lot of problems in the future, but overcoming, like, I guess psychological tics isn't one of them.
Yeah. Well, I guess Reg Barkley kind of spelled that out for us. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I do appreciate, we've always asked ourselves, you know, are Tilly and Burnham, like, actually friends? Like, people keep saying they are, but we don't really get that many moments of them acting like friends. I did appreciate that Burnham had the chance to kind of coach Tilly through. And I also, I did like the idea, you know, Burnham's specialty is, you know, in first contact. She is kind of that xenobiologist. And she got the opportunity to kind of try to figure things out with Sukal. Like, I do appreciate it when we get to see our characters not just brute force their way out of situations, but actually use their brains. And so there were some moments in this episode that I can appreciate from a character perspective.
I did enjoy Burnham impersonating the computer program. I thought that was a fun way to handle that situation. I feel really bad for Bill Irwin, the actor who played Sukal, because Bill Irwin, very good actor. He was in, was it Rachel Getting Married with Anne Hathaway?
Yep.
Is that the name of it?
Yep. Yeah. And Tunde Adebinje.
Yeah, he was the father in that film. He was also the voice of the main robot in Interstellar. Like, Bill Irwin is an actor who works a lot. He's great. And I'm like, this is the character that this guy has to play? Oh, dear, do I feel sorry for you, Mr. Irwin.
This is what irks me, though. I don't know if it's the writers, I don't know if it's the actors, but when you have adult actors pretending to be children, they always act as if they're like wood nymphs. But if you actually like talk to a child, they're actually far more adult. You know, like children are trying to imitate adults. So they don't like prance around like wood nymphs. And that's what we got with this performance from Bill Irwin, which is weird because I like him as an actor as well. But this is just like, it like he might as well have had a pacifier in his mouth, like for every scene that he wasn't speaking, right?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's frustrating if it's not handled well, where you have a character that's clearly very unstable mentally. And so the rare moment of clarity is entirely dictated by when the writers need them to do something. Otherwise, they just keep going back to their initial state, which then just basically throws up a blockade for the characters, which is so frustrating when it's not done well. And I really thought it was done poorly here, where I was really fed up with this character. When I was watching him struggle with that kelp monster, going back to the kelp monster for a billionth time, what it really brought to mind to me was that episode, The Alternative Factor, with Lazarus struggling with his alternate self. And that's like my most hated episode of the original series. And it's not something I ever thought I would flash back to watching another episode of Star Trek, but it's all I could think about in that moment.
You know, jumping off of that point, though, just with regards to the story that they gave Sukal, are you familiar at all with, you know, the Plato's cave allegory?
I don't know. Let the listeners know and I'll see if I am.
Okay. But essentially, Plato, the philosopher, he made an allegory about prisoners chained in a cave in which they were born. And all they've ever done is stared at a blank wall and there's a fire behind them. So to them, reality is just shadows, and they don't know what reality is as we know it because they've never stepped outside this cave. So plopping a character into this holo program to Sukal, that is his reality. And they do kind of scratch the surface on that in this episode. I want them to dive even deeper. I just like it. There's such an opportunity for them to have so much fun with this whole setup of an episode, whether it's characters looking like different aliens or kind of hopping around the evolution and history of the Federation, and even touching on Plato's cave allegory. There's some great opportunities there. So this one, it just came off as ultimately a misfire for me. It may have worked better for me if this had been episode 5 versus episode 11 as well. I'll grant it that. But I think if we're in the home stretch of the season, it's a very frustrating episode as well.
I do agree. Had you done this way earlier, we could have actually developed the Sukal character, dealt with obviously the powers he has and the implications of what he's able of, you know, doing over the course of several episodes. Like, why this season were we going over to the Mirror Universe to set up a George O spinoff? Like, why not deal with the things like this that seem to matter to the show? Like, and I think there's like good ideas in this episode and in the next episode that I'm like, why did we not deal with this so much earlier and actually dive deeper into these concepts? That's something Discovery, I know that the writers would never, ever, you know, reveal this about themselves, but they do not like to dive deeply into anything.
Yeah.
And that's something that the other Star Trek shows really did a lot. And, you know, I don't know. Like, I look at these things they're doing, episodes like Die Trying with the Borazan, you know, scientist, or this with the, whether with Sukal or some of the other concepts, it's all surface level stuff. And it's very thin. Like, it doesn't feel like they're actually engaging with the material so much as, hey guys, this is just like the Star Trek you know and love. You've seen this in, you know, X episode of TNG or what have you.
I'll just jump in briefly because there might be a few listeners that are screaming into their earbuds, but it's Barzan. That was the...
did I say... Okay.
Yeah, but...
I'm back in symbiote land.
Yes. To your point, though, I think one of the most egregious examples of that is Lorca. In, you know, what was motivating Lorca all of season one? Well, we find out he's just an evil guy that wants to run the Terran Empire, which is far less interesting than what he was originally established as a captain suffering from deep, deep traumatic experiences with what we thought was the loss of his crew. So it's just... Discovery does have an issue with kind of scratching below the surface. Cam, have you watched the Disney Pixar film Soul recently?
I have. Yes, I have.
This is a children's movie. And you think about how they go so deep into existentialism, and it's for children as well. I'm just like, why can't Discovery, which benefited from having Kemp Powers on its writing staff previously, and Kemp Powers co-wrote Soul... I don't know why Discovery can't, you know, go below the surface more frequently.
Not only that, Discovery wants its R-rated violence and everything, but it's not willing to engage with higher intellectual concepts for adult audiences. Like, what are they, if they want to dumb it down, why don't they just come out and just say, we're just an action show. That's what we are.
Yeah.
Don't keep, like, gussing this up as we are staying true to the philosophical spirit of Star Trek. It's like, no, you're not. Like, Pixar's doing better Star Trek at this point than you guys are.
Yeah. Okay, well, jumping off of that, because we can get into the philosophical spirit of Star Trek as well in There Is a Tide, the follow-up episode. I do appreciate that they jumped immediately into the action, because it actually took about, I think, like 18 or 19 minutes of Sukal until they actually jumped into like what the crux of the story was going to be here. It's just like, yeah, we are, it's a ship takeover episode. We're invading, you know, Federation HQ. Let's go at it. I'm just like, okay, now you've got things going. But I don't know if, I wonder if the writers greatly overestimated how much we are excited to see Evil Tavern Man, aka Zara, from earlier this season. Because like, when he walks in and he shows off his dead hand to Tilly, I think that was supposed to be a jump from your couch and cheer, kind of like we love to hate him sort of character. I was so indifferent to seeing that guy return once more.
I mean, Zara maybe won me over a little more in this episode, and that his energy level was so low that I began to just admire it, because it's a show where obviously a lot of the time the emotions are amped up to 11 all the time. Characters are snarking and everything's like rapid fire. And I love that this character is half asleep. Like, that actually kind of amused me.
Okay, I get it. I get it. I did appreciate the return of one, you know, Kenneth Mitchell. We know him. He played Cole, and he also played the son of Laurel and Ash Tyler, a.k.a. Voke, back in season two. He's back here as Aurelio, a invigilator the greatest scientist in this side of the galaxy, or at least within the Osira chain. For listeners that don't know, Kenneth Mitchell, after he had played those characters in Star Trek Discovery, he had been diagnosed with ALS, and he is now wheelchair-bound. And so I do appreciate that they are bringing this actor back. It's an actor that clearly the producers love having on the show, and it, it explains why, like, he's in the wheelchair. And it kind of reminded me of the Pike wheelchair that we saw last season as well. I suspect it's probably just a refurbished one from the storage center that the prop master has. But that was kind of interesting to see him pop up. But ultimately, this episode, Cam, it left me a little deflated, especially thinking that there's only one episode left to go in Star Trek Discovery Season 3.
I was more up on this episode. Like, I don't think this was a great episode by any stretch of the imagination, but after the previous one, this one was actually, it grabbed me a lot more. There's stuff that I can criticize about it that I'm sure we'll delve into, but it had moments where characters just talked, and I was like, wow, this is actually really compelling stuff. I'm watching Stamets have a discussion with Kenneth Mitchell's character, and I actually care about what they're talking about, and I'm invested in what they're saying, and it doesn't sound like dopey exposition dialogue. It actually feels like two smart characters having a conversation. So, like, this episode offered, to me, a lot more than the previous one.
Okay. If you want to hear some dopey exposition dialogue, I have a line that I transcribed just for this.
Awesome.
So pretend you're Book, and I'm Burnham. We've just crash-landed into the shuttle bay. The fire suppression unit is on. It's my time to take this device that can mask my life signs. Book is telling me, you better go. I turn to Book and I say, is this the wrong moment to tell you I love you for the first time? No one speaks like this in real life. If you're about to tell someone I love you and you've never told them that before, you don't ever say, is this the wrong moment to tell you I love you for the first time? The reason why she says for the first time is because the viewers of the show may have assumed that she said that to him before, but the writers know that maybe she hasn't. So they need to spell it out to us and really, really drive it home. I just wonder if sometimes it's those words, those moments that aren't articulated out loud that work better, especially with Stamets is having like a complete meltdown and he's saying, my entire life is in that nebula. You don't need to spell it out like that. We get it. We know that Culber's there. We know that Adir is there. We can understand just by how he's acting. We don't need to have him scream what's literally going on in his own, you know, inner monologue.
Well, it's like I said, very superficial Discovery often is. I don't know why I phrased that like Yoda, but but yeah, like it will never leave it to the audience to just draw their own conclusions. I don't understand why. I often feel like Discovery is making me feel like I'm insane, where I will watch the show and I'll walk away being like, oh, that was really badly done. And then I'll see a lot of people very enthusiastic online, and I start to go like, am I just nuts? Like, is there something I'm missing? Am I that person that was like complaining about, I don't know, DS9 when it launched, or, you know, Enterprise or something, that now we look back so fondly? And like, I really start to question myself, but then I just go, no. Like, I moments like this where characters just exclaim things like this, in any other film, people would be ridiculing it. I think we give it a lot of a bit of a pass because it's a beloved franchise.
I agree. And look, I know it's, we keep saying it. I know it's probably a little painful for listeners to listen to a podcast in which the reason you're listening to this podcast is because you are totally engaged with this franchise. You want it to be great. And if you have two hosts that are just kind of crapping on it, but I think we're not delivering critiques that I think are just stupid critiques, you know, like, oh, we don't like the haircut of this character, therefore it's not an interesting character. We're diving into why the storytelling and why the execution often falls flat for us. And look, I understand it works for a lot of people. There's a lot of stuff about Discovery that we like. We like a lot of the characters on the show, and that's why it's all that much more frustrating, where I just think, like, if I was a writer on the series and I had the opportunity to bring a ship 1,000 years into the future and have this ship be a beacon of hope for a new Federation, I think I would have come up with so many better stories than this, so many better scripts than this, and seized on this opportunity rather than make everything hang around on this Osira chain and the burn, which I so don't care about the Osira chain. Or not the Osira chain, the Emerald chain.
Right, right. It reminds me a little bit of after Star Trek 2009. You remember the end of 2009 where it's like, oh my God, the sky is the limit. We can go anywhere and do anything. And then Into Darkness rolls around and they're on Earth battling Khan for a lot of it and recreating Wrath of Khan. You're like, wow, that's really underachieving compared to, you know, or in comparison to what you were promising at the end of the last movie. And I feel like that's what Discovery's done here again with, you know, Star Trek, is that the end of season two, it's like, we are going into the future. You are not even going to believe what's out there. And this is what we're doing. And it's kind of just like, really? Like, I don't really understand how people were that passionate about this. It's very strange. I don't understand why the penultimate episode of season three is a diehard riff. Like, it's kind of weird, even though I enjoyed it more or less. Like, I enjoyed this as a standalone Discovery episode more than, well, at least several of the episodes that have come before this. It's just weird.
I did get a good laugh when maybe my most entertained moment for this one was when Burnham lost her boots and she had been stabbed in the leg. There's this one shot of her running away, and she looks hilarious as she's hobbling in her bare feet away. Like, I need to make a gif out of it. She looks like a penguin trying to sprint across a racetrack.
I thought they were going to make more of the lack of shoes thing.
I wish they had, like... I don't know, like hillbilly banjo music playing.
And Zara chasing behind her.
Yeah. And they have a banjo duel, like, yeah.
It's like Deliverance.
Deliverance. That's I couldn't remember the name of that, but yeah, it'd be like the Deliverance banjo duel. That'd be amazing if that's what the climax is of episode 13, the season finale.
I mean, at this point, I wouldn't take it off the table.
Well, do you know what? I'm not taking off the table. It's that it's the Qualaket, the Romulan nuns. They're going to come save the day. Is that what we can expect?
They seem to be the cavalry. You know, we've got the regulators, and I think the warrior nuns might be the cavalry.
So this episode or the season is going to really conclude with kind of a dramatic sort of action sequence. There's going to be a lot of brute forcing their way out of the situation, and then they'll have some sort of setup for, you know, the next season. My suspicion is the setup is going to be, now it's Burnham's turn to be in command.
I would think so. Yeah, I mean, I'm still unsure if they're going to actually do something to solve the burn versus just acknowledge what caused it. I'm not really sure how they do that or what kind of drastic changes that could make to the characters going forward. But, yeah, I mean, it seems like Burnham's going to be the captain. I mean, we had her in the previous episode, like, questioning whether Saru was okay, basically, in command. I'm like, I don't know that you should be questioning people in command, Burnham, but okay. But, yeah, that seems to be the way it's going. I agree.
It just seems like such a kick in the face for anyone who's a fan of Saru's character that this is what's ultimately going to come of him, where... We're just being told that, no, he really isn't as good deep down of a captain as Burnham has the potential to be.
Well, does anyone? Is there any character in the history of Star Trek who has the potential of Michael Burnham?
That's what the writers certainly think, even though Giorgio was like, Michael, you're so much greater than you think you are. I'm just like, okay, sure. Like, Michael thinks he's pretty great.
I liked when Bookend, this one was like, go save the day, Michael. And I was like, she always does.
Always does. Doesn't matter what crazy decisions she's made in the moments leading up to everything. She's always validated by the end of the season or the end of the episode. Doesn't matter what she does. It's like she's always right. And I'm just like, Okay. Well then.
Let's talk about my favorite part of the episode and also a part of the episode that filled me with some frustration about the overall season, which was Osira's discussions with Vance Refrigeration. I thought this was pretty dynamite. I like that this villain had a plan that actually made sense in terms of why she thought this might work, but also how it benefits both parties. I like the idea of it. Why were we not dealing with this throughout the season and building up this character as someone we could actually invest in as a villain versus someone who's like killing her minions and commanding like the Foot Clan in this episode? Like, why did this villain not get set up as a three-dimensional character that we could actually deal with throughout the season? That could have been something so great.
Well, she does seem very kind of mustache twirling throughout her preceding, I think, you know, two or three appearances. And so there are moments, though, where I was just kind of I was rubbing my chin. I do appreciate that they had the lie detecting hologram in there, because then you were like, OK, so she is engaging in good faith negotiations over this armistice. But like, there's some curious stuff, though, where like Vance Refrigeration is like, OK, well, you're going to have to go on trial. And he's got to know that that's going to be a no-go for her. So what is that? Like, I'm wondering what his ultimate plan is, if not to actually have any sort of armistice signed. And I still find it troubling that armistice negotiations are not going on with the civilian government, but with, you know, the military arm of the Federation, a.k.a. Starfleet. It's always that authoritarian bent that Star Trek, the franchise, has always had, and it continues on here during these negotiations. So it was interesting. I just wish that this is more like episode 6 or 7 versus episode 12.
Would this have worked better if they'd presented Emerald Chain as not just like a criminal syndicate and presented them more as something that's not the Dominion, but something like that, where it's just an alternative to the Federation that maybe has motives or concepts that don't necessarily mesh well with the Federation, but we might actually be more willing to suspend our disbelief that this could potentially be a solution for these two characters?
Well, because then you're talking about Grays, and not the character that we wish had been featured more throughout the season, but we're talking about like kind of gray areas of Star Trek, but they present it as so absolute, as in like the Emerald Chain is bad, the Federation is good. But what if there were a lot of good elements in the Emerald Chain, and they do kind of say, well, we support scientists, you know, but the thing is they have so many like slapstick evil moments that you know that they are just ultimately poison fruit, you know, and like if the Federation consumes that poison fruit, then aren't they just as complicit with all these bad things, even though the Emerald Chain is making concessions to do away with slavery within 15 years? Even with the Cardassians, you could understand that there were shades of gray within that society. It wasn't just kind of like all these mustache twirling villains as portrayed throughout. And you have like characters Gregor, or I feel bad that kind of that father figure towards Kira when she had taken on the looks of the Cardassian agent, like those sorts of moments. Like these were fully fleshed out characters, whereas everyone in the Emerald Chain, except for, I guess, Rin, who had to be vaporized just to prove what a baddie Osira is, you know, it's just they're all kind of like slapstick evil.
Yeah, and I mean, the Kenneth Mitchell character was a step in the right direction because I really enjoyed that character. But it's the type of character you go like, oh, like, where was this character a few episodes ago? I think that could have been really interesting, versus a single episode of being kind of the conscience of the Emerald Chain. Like, guys, like, set that up earlier. It just, why rush through it in one episode? I just think it could have been so much more interesting and layered.
Well, the other thing that confused me, though, and you mentioned it, you know, like, it was supposed to be this criminal syndicate. Like, it was it came out from what the Orion Syndicate was, right? So she's now Minister Osira, why is she talking about Congress? Like, they presented it to the Emerald Chain Congress. Where did this come from?
I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, it's like, again, wasn't this something they could have set up, you know, back in episode 1 or 2 or something? Like, it's weird because, like, Star Trek Discovery, it's this weird combination. It's where you know that they've kind of mapped out all the big plot points in advance, and then they kind of reverse engineered the season to fit all those plot points, no matter, you know, how much you're jamming that, you know, square peg into a round hole. It's that in combination with them really making things up where it's very clear that they're just coming up with these details on the fly that could have been set up much earlier, and it would have made a lot more sense to have it set up much earlier too.
Yeah, you look at the first episode of this season, right? And we were introduced to the Emerald Chain. I don't know if they were referred to by name at that point. I don't think they were, but if they were, I apologize.
I don't think they were. I just remember Burnham commenting on how Andorians and Orions were working together.
Yeah, but look at that episode. They were cannon fodder villains like stormtroopers. And I don't watch Star Wars and be like, you know, the Rebels and the Empire just need to get on the same page. And the problem was they presented Emerald Chain as basically like the Empire through the season, where they're just villains that pop up. Zara, sorry, he's introduced in episode 2, doesn't put a good face on the Emerald Chain. That's not your, you know, remember that episode? They said Tilly, she always gives a good first impression. No one has said that about Zara.
Right.
Ever. And they never will.
But okay, here's another thing that I just find so like strange about the way that Star Trek Discovery is written, though. It's like, why couldn't Zara have just popped up like at least one more time in between that initial episode and his random appearance here? Like, just to set him up in the background, maybe in the Scavengers episode. He did not have to have that. We could have still waited for that confrontation with Tilly until this episode, so it would have been interesting. But then you have a character like Rin, who he disappeared for like 3 or 4 episodes at a time, and then he reappears, and then is gone again for 2 episodes, and then he's in this episode just to be vaporized, and Gray is gone for long stretches, and it's just like the writers keep... I don't think they realize how disconcerting it is to have characters just randomly pop in and pop out, but when they are there, we're being told in the audience, like, oh, this is a very important character that you should be paying attention to. I'm just like, well, why aren't they kind of more in the background more frequently then?
I was surprised in the previous episode they paid for Tig Notaro to do like 3 lines or something. I was kind of stunned because that's usually a character that only shows up when she has something kind of important to do. But
yeah,
at the same time, I was just glad to see her there as a member of the crew doing something. And I think you could have easily worked in, you know, a Zara or just some of these other characters throughout this season so that they feel like they belong in this world and in the overarching story of the season. It's just, it's so strange. I find a lot of the writing in this season so strange and the way they've used their characters. Because, you know, you look at, I don't know, like early Voyager, you'll see like Joe Carey pop up in a number of episodes. It's not like the character just vanishes until he's important. He's there. He may not do a lot. Or Eddington, for that matter. Yeah. These characters do matter in the long haul. They may not be your favorite characters in the history of Star Trek, and I'm referring to Carey, of course, but we understand who they are because they feel like a member of the crew throughout the season. So, like, why wouldn't you not do that? Because, okay, Tig Notaro may be more expensive, obviously, but, like, a lot of these actors, a lot of them are, like, Toronto actors. They could have easily worked them into the show.
Well, and okay, that's just okay. So the characters that are always around, you know, the bridge crew, for example, they're always there. But we also know that just by the way that the show is written, they're not important. Whereas we do know that characters like Rin or Zara, they're much more integral to the plot mechanics of whatever respective episodes that they do appear in. So it's just strange that They're like, and I know there's a difference in how much you have budgeted for, you know, stars, you know, versus kind of the day players to a certain degree. You know, I get that, but it's just odd how they just let these characters drift off and make them pop in again just at random, where it seems very easy that you could have inserted a character like Zara back into Scavengers or even the Sanctuary. And then it would have actually made more sense for him to be kind of the big muscle by the time we get to this Die Hard episode that was airing just a few days after Christmas.
I mean, with Rin, do you think we were supposed to feel something about that character dying?
I honestly have no idea what the point of even introducing this character to the series was at this point. If all they were going to do with him is have Osira vaporize him, and I guess the point is that Aurelio begins to see that Osira's the bad person that he's being told she is, you know, was that the entire meaning of Rin's arc, is to have Aurelio see that? Like, I guess, I don't know. It's kind of like, to me, it just seems so strange.
And is Aurelio the one that ultimately helps bring down Osira? Like, okay, so let's just say that
what they're going to do.
It seems like they're pointing in that direction at this moment. We may be disproven next week, but we'll go with that for now. If that is the case, this character's, like, comeuppance was a character who was just introduced in the episode previously?
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah. It's like, I don't understand it. I'd be down to see Aurelio come back in season 4. I think that could be interesting. I think Kenneth Mitchell would love to continue on his streak appearing in every single season of Star Trek Discovery. So maybe we can hope that, you know, Rin had to meet his maker for the benefit of a new character that will grow to love. I don't know. I'm trying to give Discovery the benefit of the doubt here.
And to be fair, Aurelio has been already more interesting than Rin. Rin, I think we debated whether that was a character that was going to join the show because, again, we don't have an Andorian in the crew. That's kind of interesting. I don't know why they were spending time giving us scenes of Rin talking to crew members in the cafeteria if this character would amount to really nothing. But it felt like they were going to maybe try to do something. At least with Aurelio, we actually have a relationship with Stamets, and we have a character that seems smart and actually has an interesting, you know, point of view on the world, of especially the time zone they're in now. Like, that's something that could be interesting. I'm down for it. I've lost my faith in Discovery basically introducing elements and knowing how to evolve them or exploit them to their fullest dramatic potential.
Okay, before we get to the season finale, what do you think this setup might be like for season 4? Like, what do you think they might want to do for season 4 if by the time we get to next week's episode, it's going to be the conclusion of the Burn arc and probably the conclusion of this Emerald Chain arc, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to see Osira go down in flames, literally. Yeah. I think that's probably the end of the season. By the way, did you know that that actress is Margot Kidder's niece?
I did not, no.
Yeah, I noticed the resemblance, and then I looked it up online. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, same last name, makes sense. But anyways,
Margot Syrah.
Yeah, there you go. So I feel like that character is definitely going to, you know, get blown up or something in the finale. I just don't think this is a character that's going to be carried over into season 4. But in terms of the Burn thing, I'm genuinely baffled where that's going, because so much of this season has been Burnham endlessly going on about how she has to, you know, I don't know, undo the burn or something.
No. It's not even undo the burn. It's I need to find out what caused the burn, and only then can the Federation rebuild itself. It's like, how do you know that? And it's, as you said it, Cam, a couple episodes ago, it's, well, she's obviously read the season finale script.
Yeah. And I mean, we do have that planet that, you know, could help them out with dilithium. So I guess that solves that, I guess. Is that the solution to the season?
Maybe there can be an agreement where it's not a, maybe it's not the Federation and the Emerald Chain, merging, but maybe it's the Federation getting the Emerald Chain to agree to get rid of slavery, and in exchange they'll offer free access to dilithium to them, maybe the Klingons, you know, other species that wish to rejoin the Federation. Maybe that's how things are resolved.
Or maybe Osira is killed and someone like Aurelio takes over the Emerald Chain, and we get a united chain and Federation, maybe?
Well, it seemed as if she was going to pick Aurelio as her representative to the Federation.
Yep.
The thing is, like, when we left off of the season 1, we're like, oh, okay, like, it wasn't a great finale, but it had a great cliffhanger moment. And we knew going into season 2, they'd have to deal with the appearance of the 1701, which was interesting. When we departed season two, we're like, oh, wow, we're going 1,000 years into the future. I wonder what's next for Discovery and company. Going forward this, my hope is we finally get what I thought the promise of season three is going to be, in which it's actually about rebuilding the Federation, where this season seems to have been about discovering the cause of the burn. Like, that's not what I thought we were going to get when we jumped into this season.
And also, it's not that we thought we'd get it, but also that it's okay if they don't give us what we expect. I actually appreciate when TV shows give me what I don't expect. It's that they didn't give us something interesting in the place of rediscovering or rebuilding the Federation. It's that they gave us this. Like, that's the problem. Not that it was different than what we expected. So I do wonder, though, because if you look at the previous two, they really left you with a major hook for the next season. There's got to be something tied to that, right? Like, this has to end next week with some sort of hook for next season that is going to have people, in theory, talking, right? Like, they're not just going to end it with, okay, we are good to go with rebuilding the Federation, the end. Like, there has to be something, right? Like, a tease of something that is a fan favorite character or concept or something.
My guess, honestly, is it's going to be Vance Refrigeration saying, we've figured out the burn, now let's rebuild the Federation. And the episode ends with Burnham sitting in the captain's seat saying something like, you know, second star to the right and straight on till morning, you know, like something along, you know what I'm getting at. Like, I think that's what we're going for. And I think we're going to be unsatisfied with the finale next week.
Well, I mean, the way I slingshotted back and forth between, Sukal and this episode in terms of hating the episode and then somewhat enjoying the, you know, There Is a Tide, like, it's not great, but I could enjoy a lot of elements of it. I'm not going to say that I won't walk out of the finale and be like, that was all right. But I don't think it's going to be the, you know, it's not going to be the Dominion invasion arc at the end of what season five DS9. Like, I don't think it's going to be a call to arms.
You think it's more going to be like Sisko washing clams in a bucket for the season six finale?
Sure. Where I go, well, I'm back in for next season, but that's not the high I was hoping to go out on.
Although all you had to do is stick another disc in your DVD player. I had to wait like 3.5 months. That was brutal, man.
True. But I do remember after a call to arms, or just call to arms, right? There's no A in front of it, right?
I think you're correct. Yeah.
Yeah. After that episode, I was like fighting to get the disc in, like, to start the next episode. Like, I was so excited. Whereas I don't know that when I was watching Sisko, like, shuck clams or whatever he's doing, or washing potatoes, I don't think that I was, like, diving for that season seven set.
It was kind of a bummer of a finale as well, because, like, Jadzia was dispatched in a very unceremonious way. We had more Costa Mojin stuff, which we were never really big fans of. And that last shot is kind of a bummer. I do appreciate, you know, Kira pointing out that Sisko took his baseball. Like, I thought that was a great moment in an otherwise kind of disappointing season finale.
They probably should have just ended it with he took the baseball and not the shot of him, like, washing potatoes.
But what's more iconic now? I think the shot of him, like, washing taters or shucking clams. I like how, like, 25 years later, people still are uncertain as to what he's doing with that bucket. But at least we got some good fodder for the podcast there.
Very true. Also, Tyler, I can't believe we've skipped over it. The final moment of There Is a Tide, of the Sphere Data in the form of bots approaching Tilly to help. How did we not mention this off the top of the episode? I don't know. I thought I'd lost my mind.
I rolled my eyes so hard that I looked like Stamets as he's about to go into the Spore Drive.
Oh, I called him Franken Stamets.
I just, like, and like when they were teasing it with more Buster Keaton, like, videos, I was just like, I don't care, guys. I don't need more Buster Keaton shoutouts. And lo and behold, I don't know, the Sphere Data's in the dots. It's going to help save the ship, I guess. I just, like, okay, I don't, okay. this is what's frustrating as well, is because I don't think this sort of stuff, you know, how do they save Discovery? That's not the story of the season. That's a plot point within the season. And I'm very worried that they're going to spend so much time resolving this plot point while ignoring what the story is. And the story ultimately is, it's a new crew, or it's a very old crew flung through time that hold the ideals of the Federation that has kind of fallen by the wayside. And they feel the best way to help bring those ideals back is discovering the source of this mystery that you and I don't find all that compelling, but at least I understand what the story is. I'm very fearful that too much of the plot is going to be the center of the finale next week. That's my fear.
Yeah, I do agree. And I mean, when those bots showed up, another thing, they didn't set this up at all. We had that one episode where like Saru is like, huh, boy, the computer's sure acting weird. That's abnormal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, nothing is really done with it. And then we have the bots showing up here being like, well, we're ready to retake the ship, guys. It's like, again, I feel like I'm just repeating myself over and over again. And I apologize, listeners, if it sounds like I'm doing that. But why wasn't this dealt with in previous episodes? Why was none of this fleshed out? It just feels like they had the resolutions they wanted for their finale, and they just threw darts at cards to see which episode it would be introduced in.
I also wonder, though, if they're fearful of, if they set things up too much, or they give too many hints, then you're going to have those Reddit detectives that kind of figure out what the twist is, like, weeks before the writers get to, you know? But the thing is, it's a very small proportion of the audience that are devoting their time to that those social media threads in which those kinds of things are revealed. So it's just unsatisfying as a viewer when all of these things are just kind of brought up haphazardly without that much setup, because then the payoff isn't all that great either.
Yeah, because I didn't know that this was a thing. Like, the Sphere data was really out of mind for me. I mean, we had the teasing of the more advanced AI, you know, having a conversation with Saru. But it wasn't like it was a factor of the season where I was really even paying attention to it. So to pay that off is like, oh, yeah, I completely forgot about that. That's right. That was a thing.
How do we make heads or tails of the Calypso short trek at this point?
I continue to struggle with deciding whether or not they're just going to kind of shuttle that one off aside and just be like, ah, just don't worry about it.
Yeah, it is kind of strange in that maybe they'll have some stuff that'll come up in the finale or maybe season 4 that will kind of explain it. But that Calypso short trek, we loved it. But thinking about everything that unfolded in that now, it's so weird at this point in that I can't really reconcile how it even exists within this universe that they've been setting up up until now.
It also seems highly unlikely for this team to be setting up something in like season 4 or 5 in a season 1 short trek. They don't seem to have that ability to see these things that far down the road.
Yeah. Well, another thing I was going to save until next week, but I'll just throw this out to you as well. I think we mentioned a couple weeks ago, we were kind of disappointed that the reason behind the fall of the Federation wasn't because, you know, it became kind of a somewhat old and maybe even corrupt sort of, you know, form of governance that just, you know, fell out of favor with most planets. It was because of an external event. It wasn't anything internal, but a completely external event was what caused that. And then it got me thinking a little bit about how they could have played it far more interesting if they even just took a page out of Mandalorian, where you got to see those stormtroopers walking around in like dirty uniforms a lot, like those Imperial remnants. You know, it would have been interesting if you had the idea of like Federation remnants as well. And maybe those uniforms that we see Vance Refrigeration wearing, maybe they aren't as slick. You know, maybe they are a little bit run down. There's a couple of patches in the knees that have been sewn up. You know, maybe there's an even better reason why he's eating his own feces, as he explains to Osira. Like, I think that could have been a more interesting sort of way of depicting the Federation versus, yeah, some external event that we had no control over. It caused us to kind of fall out of favor with other planets. Like, that's not so interesting to me.
No. Maybe even if they'd had some sort of older uniforms, because they, you know, the Federation hadn't developed past a certain point. Like, they were kind of trying to recreate the past in the future. Like, I think that could have been kind of interesting as well. That seemed to be maybe a little bit of what they were glimmering towards with that guy who was the guardian of, or was he the signal guy? The guy who monitored signals or something like that in the premiere?
Salil, the guy that we had so much excitement for, that final moment of his, we're like, oh, we can't wait to see what he has to do throughout the remainder of the season. And we never saw him ever again.
Yeah, he's sitting at that station just waiting for another signal, I guess.
At least he's been given a commission by Burnham, so he's got that going for him.
Sure, I guess.
It just, like, I know, listeners, it's like, you're probably not enjoying us rag on the show, but it's like, Kim, we thought that there's just so much potential for season three Discovery, and it just seems like they've just totally biffed it. Like, they have not been telling interesting stories when they were given nothing but opportunities to do so. Like, I feel like I'm not a TV writer, but I feel like I could have pitched like so many better things to them to follow up on. And it's not contingent on a season long arc in which the mystery behind it all isn't all that interesting.
No, it really sucks to basically be in the same sort of territory we were at the end of Picard, so soon after Picard. Like, I don't mind a bad season every now and again. Like, had we been grappling with season 5 Discovery and it was really lousy, like, that would be a different thing. The fact that we have the two of them landing in basically the same calendar year is just a bummer.
Yeah. And then, again, for those that may not have listened to us talk about Lower Decks, we really liked Lower Decks. Like, we thought it took maybe 2-3 episodes to really kind of find its footing, which happens with most shows. And then they just had fun within this universe in which they acknowledge what makes Star Trek great. And sure, there's the fan service. There's the nostalgia factor. We could easily succumb to that. But I don't think that was the reason why we like Star Trek Lower Decks so much, Cam. It was like, we loved the characters. We thought they had a lot of fun within the universe. And it really felt as if it was produced in the spirit of what makes Star Trek so great and what drew us in the first place. And I just don't get that same sense of having fun within the Star Trek universe on Discovery, or especially Picard, which it's mostly just kind of miserable depictions of this universe.
It doesn't seem like it's very optimistic, or like, I don't want to live in the Discovery future. And
no,
that's something that the other shows, you know, previous to the Kurtzman era, really were very good at, was presenting a future that you wanted to live in. Like, it sounded like utopia in so many ways. Yeah, it was a little boring when it's the TNG crew listening to jazz every night, but it was ultimately a very positive experience with people that seemed well-adjusted. And you said, like, yeah, I would like to live, you know, the lives that they have of exploration. And I don't want to be on the Discovery crew. It looks like hell.
Yeah. I keep thinking about, like, would you, if I was rediscovering Star Trek for the first time, like I was, I was 7 or 8 when I got into Star Trek. I don't think something like Discovery or Picard would draw me in. I would watch this and be just like, oh, this is rather depressing, you know?
It's very telling that the original series, so many episodes end with the crew just laughing together, and so many episodes of Discovery feature the crew crying.
Although we do forget, season 1 and 2 of Discovery, it was nonstop shots of the crew cheering every episode.
That's true.
Yeah, we haven't got that much crew cheering in season 3, so I guess the writers are capable of learning.
Yeah. Was there a little bit of a celebration when they took down the guards in this episode?
I'm sure there was. It was Rin clicking his heels together right before getting vaporized, right?
Something like that. Watching a Washington take down that guy was pretty badass, though.
I did like the Morse code moment, even though I'm very skeptical that they're still teaching Morse code in 22nd century Starfleet Academy. But their chair barricade of, like, these cheap-ass IKEA seats, I'm just like, that's not a very good barricade, guys.
Well, it didn't seem to really do that much for them, so.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, I think we know what we're doing next week.
Well, wait, Cam, is anyone enjoying listening to this podcast? Is anyone going to write in with praise of how enjoyable us complaining about the show that they love is? Like, I don't blame it if like some listeners have been dropping off, but yeah, you can look forward to us probably dunking on the season finale, but I'm going in with an open mind. I hope they come out swinging and they hit a home run. That's all I can hope for. Every episode I watch of Discovery, I have that hope in front of me. So I continue to have that with next week's season 3 finale.
The fact that I could make it through Sukal and then find enjoyment in the next episode shows there's always hope.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, okay, you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vaporizing Rin, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in not eating any apple pie from Vance, Vance Refrigeration.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.